If you're just joining us today, or you haven't been in a while, I have been speaking to you on the life and ministry of the great prophet Elijah under the general heading, What God Can Do Through Ordinary You. Elijah, the Tishbite. He comes from obscurity, born in poverty, lived a secluded life until the hand of God touched him and put him on what would eventually be the world stage. God preparing him in private, doing something extraordinary through what the scripture tells us was a very ordinary man, subject to like passions that you and I have. So, the life of Elijah, fascinating. I'm not going to recap everything. This is sermon number 7. And my subject today under this heading is battles that baffle us. Battles that baffle us. I ask you this question. Do you ever find yourself confused about the struggles in your everyday life? I'm talking about those things that just come from nowhere. You don't understand them. You don't know why it's happening. It may be something small. It may be something big. But it is something that just upsets that good moment or that good day that you may be having. Battles that baffle us. The word battle is perplexed, confused, mystified, befuddled. As I've told you before, sometimes you can evaluate your problems and they usually come under one of three or four different headings. Sometimes it's a problem that I bought. You know what I mean? I have to own it because I'm responsible for it. Bad choice I made for whatever reason. Sometimes it's a problem that I borrow by worrying about something that may or may not happen. So I bring a possible problem into today, and that disrupts life. Sometimes it's a problem that we're blessed with. That God, we can see the handiwork of God, even though it's not a good thing, but we know God's in control and he's going to do something great from it. I've spoken about those things before. But this week, God kept me in this text that I tried honestly to get out of. But it was about those problems that baffle us. Those problems that we can't say, I wasn't really born with this problem, and I don't think it's anything that I did to cause this problem, and I was singing it as well with my soul, and then out of the blue, boom, bang, here it happened. It's mystifying. It's befuddling. I don't understand why I'm experiencing this moment. And in that moment, sometimes we trade peace for confusion. We go literally from peace to absolute confusion. Or from faith to fear. Or when our weakness swallows up our strength for that moment. And in a moment's time, in almost an instant, you find yourself on your heels or on the ropes, struggling to remember what it is that helped get you out of that hole you were in to start with. Battles that baffle us, battles that mystify us, battles that disorient us or befuddle us. We can't put our finger on what it is or why it's happening. It is baffling. Now, as I said, 1 Kings chapter 20 was something that I wanted to skip over. Now you say, why would a preacher want to skip over a passage? Don't you believe in the scriptures? All of it's inspired. I believe absolutely in the inerrancy of scriptures. I believe that every single word is God-breathed. What the theologians like to call the plenary of inspiration. That means it is absolute, it is thorough, it is sweeping, it is full, complete. Everything in it is God-breathed, and I believe that. So I didn't value this passage any less. Just to be quite honest with you, it just overwhelmed me. It's a long chapter, and we're not going to look at every verse, but there's so much information in it. I didn't know how to build a sermon out of it. So I did what you may do sometimes. I go to some of my favorite commentaries, and I'll say, well, maybe they can give me a little outline here, get me started in the right direction. And I was surprised to find that it was skipped over by several of those that I relied upon. And I thought, uh-huh. I see. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to go to chapter 21 because that's pretty clear what's going on there. And by the way, can I tell you this? Next week, I mean, please do your best to be here. I'm going to speak to you on the Ahab family. It is the poster family for the dysfunctional family. And I'm going to emphasize two primary thoughts. Ahab husbands and Jezebel wives. Now, when I'm through, you're going to either hug me or slug me. You won't remain neutral on the subject. You'll like it or you'll not like it. But I hope you'll come, and it'll be preached in love, I assure you. So that's next week. What about this week? Well, as I said, a lot of information here, and I didn't know how to build a sermon on a chapter like this. Let me give you an example. It talks about two wicked kings. It starts off, you know, we're introduced with these the tale of two wicked kings. One of them is Ben-Hadad. The other is Ahab. Ben-Hadad is king of Syria. Ahab, as you know, king in Israel. And so the chapter centers around the rivalry of these two kings. There are two terrible wars mentioned in this chapter. Three, if you count verse 1, where it is where Ben-Hadad does this surprise invasion on Israel and claims portions of the territory in an attempt to make him what is called a vassal king. In other words, he's going to take over this area, but he's going to have to pay tribute now to the king of Syria, and he's just going to function as somewhat of a token king because kind of like organized crime where we own it and a percentage of everything you make has got to come this way. In turn, we'll protect you from all your enemies. And so this happens in verse 1. But then there are two other wars, real wars that follow, and they're incredible. The king of Syria gets a coalition of 32 regional kings, sometimes called sheikhs in those days. And they all come together with one goal in mind, or so they say. Invade Israel, capture the king, take over the land, deal with Samaria, really. That was the capital of the northern kingdom we know as Israel. And so a battle's planned. And so when they make the first battle, something strange happens. You've got Israel over here that are now, according to God's directions, are going to bypass all the Secretary of Defense and all of the generals and all of the five-star military people wearing purple hearts. He's going to tell all of them to take the backstage, and he's going to take 232 untrained, untested soldiers to lead the conflict. The battle. Why would he do this? Well, a prophet came to Ahab and said, that's what God wants. And so these 232 are going to lead the charge, and he's going to have close to 7,000, you know, backing them up. They go in, fight this battle. Well, I should tell you that Ben-Hadad and his 32 sheikhs, they get drunk. They get stoned the night before the battle. Partying. They're so overconfident. They're so arrogant. Well, when these young men lead the charge and the Israelites overtake the Syrians, tens of thousands of Syrians die, and Israel wins the battle. Now, the seers of the bad guys, the Syrians, they come to their king, Abinadab, and they say to him, "Now, king, here's the thing. Here's why we lost. It was no fault of our own. It wasn't the fact that we got stoned, got drunk the night before. It had nothing to do with that. Here's the problem. The Israelites, their God is the God of the hills. We like to fight in the plains or in the valleys. When wintertime comes, after the first of the year, let's fight them on our turf, on our terms. We'll get them down in the valley because their God is all about the hills. He can't fight in the plains." And so they plan another war. Well, because God is a faithful God, here comes the prophet knocking on Ahab's door, and he says to Ahab, said, "Well, you need to know that there's going to be more trouble." "What's the problem?" "Well, they are claiming that your God is the God of the mountain, but he's not God in the valley. So they're going to draw you into the valley, and they're going to fight you there, and they believe they can take you there." Well, the king says, he tells him what to do. He tells him how to get arrayed for battle, how to prepare for it. And then they fight another battle, and it's so interesting because there's so many Syrians armed to the teeth. I mean, multiplied thousands. They literally cover the seeable landscape with soldiers. And the Bible said when you look at the numbers and you compare this large Syrian army next to what's fighting in Israel at this time, it said it looked like two little flocks of goats going up against this massive army. They just congregated over here and congregated over here and said, I've seen goats have more in the pasture than what Israel had. But the hand of God is on them, and they win that battle again. And I could go on and on, but so many things happen in here. One preacher tells another preacher to punch him in the face, and he won't do it, and so because he disobeyed, a lion comes out and kills him. He tells another preacher, "Hit me in the face." He hits him in the face, blacks his eye. He fakes or pretends that he's been beaten up by escaped prisoner of war so he can illustrate the message to Ahab. I mean, I'm telling you, I could go on and on and on. There's so much here. A wall falls down. 27,000 people died, and the king gets on his horse, escapes, and runs and hides in a closet, shaking for fear. There's a lot of stuff happening in 1 Kings 20, and it's real interesting, but I don't know how to preach all that in 30 minutes. So I said, "Now, Lord, why are they doing this anyway? Why did they attack Israel? What happened?" And there were unanswered questions. The scripture doesn't tell us why, not specifically anyway. We don't know why these two kings are at odds with one another. We don't know why people have to die, problems have to exist, and are multiplied, battles that baffle us. No real explanation for what's going on here. And the most interesting thing is even though Israel wins these battles, when King Ahab goes and fights him, he really can't take any credit for it. God has so arranged it where the only real victor in the battle is God himself. And so there's no trophies given to him regarding this. And so it is an interesting passage to say the least. And so I want to kind of divide it in three or four ways and show you what I'm talking about. And let's kind of work through it. Like I said, don't worry, we're not going to touch all the verses, but I want to emphasize a point, and I hope it'll help you if you're experiencing something in your life that just really has you bewildered. You don't know why, when, or how, but I think if you'll bear with me to the end, God's got a little nugget for you, okay? Let's look at a couple of things this morning. First of all, that's why I try to explain what's going on here. There's initially, number one, an attack that devastates Israel. Chapter 20 and verse 1, the word of God says, "And Ben-Hadad..." Now, if you read some of the modern translations, and when I come up on a word I don't understand real well, I always do the audio Bible so I can help me, because I'm not so good at that all the time. So depending on which version, now in King James, it's Ben-Hadad. But if you go to some of the contemporary translations, it's Ben-Hadad. It reminded me of how we speak different, you know. Like, you know, here in Alabama, it's not the police, it's the police. It's not the motel, it's the motel. And we eat hamburgers. You know, I was listening when they, in the Middle East, for example, you know, it's not Iraq, it's Iraq. You notice that? They talk about Iraq, Iran, Iran and Iraq's what we know. And so it appears that the most authentic pronunciation is Ben-Hadad. But if I slip up and say Ben-Hadad, it's sort of because I'm from right here. Okay, so that's all free. No charge for that. He's the king of Syria, and he gathered all his host, and there were 32 kings with him, horses and chariots, and he went up, and he besieged Samaria and warred against it. Why did you do that? We don't know why he did that. But he besieged Samaria. What's Samaria? Samaria is the capital city of the northern kingdom we call Israel. Remember, it's a divided kingdom. So he decides he's going to go invade Samaria, war against it, and try to put his thumb on it, keep it under his rule. Number two, there is an abusive dialogue that goes along between these two kings that in my mind, it seems like churlish chatter. You know, like it sounds like two children on the playground fussing at each other. Let me show you what I mean. Look at a few verses with me. He sent messengers to Ahab, king of Israel, and I've talked to you about him. You know that the Bible clearly says he's the most wicked king to date that they'd ever had. He sent messengers to Ahab, king of Israel, into the city, and he said unto them, thus saith Ben-Hadad, thy silver and thy gold is mine, thy wives also and thy children, even the goodliest, are mine. So he starts this verbal abuse by sending a messenger and said, oh, by the way, I want your wives, I want your children, and I want the best of the bunch. I want the cream of the crop. They're mine. I own them now. They belong to me. Now, you'd think that Ahab, as big a bully as he is, he would respond with indignation, with vengeance. He would man up, and he would challenge him, and he would stand his ground and say, absolutely not. What, are you lost your mind? But like most bullies that go around picking on smaller people, they got a lot of cowardice in them. This is how King Ahab responds to this dialogue. Your wives and your children, the best of the best, I own them now. What does Ahab have to say? The king of Israel answered and said, my lord, O king, according to thy saying, I am thine and all that I have. You own me. I'm yours. Why would a man do that? Well, he does that, and you can take my wives, take my children, take the best of the best. I don't care. I'm yours. What he's saying is, just let me save my own hide. Don't hurt me. Do what you want to with my wives and my children and all the rest. But he's basically saying, hey, I'm your servant, because he didn't want him to hurt him. Well, Ben-Hadad decides, kind of a crazy response. He's looking for a good fight. And he said, that's a little too easy. So he tells the messenger, come here, I want you to go and deliver another message to the king. I think he must, I don't know if he heard me correctly. So look at verse 6. He said, yet I will send my servants unto thee tomorrow about this time, and thou shalt search thine house and the houses of thy servants. And it shall be that whatsoever is pleasant in thine eyes, they shall put it in their hand and take it away. He said, here's the thing. My servants are going to arrive at your house. They're going to go through it and do a search and seizure. They're going to anything, especially those things you find most pleasant, things that you treasure the most. Because evidently, you know, well, of course, he was married to Jezebel. He probably said, take my wife. But anyway, he says, what those things that you do value, he's trying to provoke a fight here. They're going to put it in their hands and they're going to take it away. I'm going to own everything. And I'm going to do the same thing to your staff, to all the men that work in your court. We're going to go in their houses and we're going to find out all that they like. And we're going to take, we want to own all of it. The greed escalates. Now, when Ahab, he's taken back by that because remember, these are the things he treasures. Typical narcissism here is, this is what's important to me. And so, no, don't think so. So he calls the elders of the city together and says, look, this guy is so mischievous. I told him he could have my wives and my children, and that wasn't good enough for him. He wants to come in our house and take all our treasures, and he wants to take yours too. The elders bow up and said, we can't allow that. That can't happen. So he protests. Ben-Hadad sent unto him and said, the gods do so to... Oh, and he says, Ahab says, I don't have it, let's crazy. That's not going to happen. We're not doing that. It's not going to happen. He basically tells him, and I don't know if I have it in my text, but he says, look, you know, one of the modern translations translated Ahab's words, don't count your chickens before you hatch, before they hatch. He says, you know, a man that puts on his weapons and harnesses them, he says he's got to take them off too, and he may not be the same one taking them off as the guy that put them on. So Ahab's getting a little irritated now, and he's standing up, and he's talking like you might expect initially. I translate the verse this way, not this one, but the one I'm referencing. He says, you tell Ben-Hadad that he may be writing a his mouth may be writing a check, his behind can't cash. I mean, I'm sorry I don't have it on the screen, but that's Thompson translation. Ben-Hadad sent unto him and said, the gods do so unto me, and more also, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handcuffs for all the people that follow me. When he finds out he's going to resist, he says, okay, I'm going to tell you something. I can promise you, you think you own that land, there won't be enough dust left in Samaria for every man there to have a handful. You're not going to own anything when I get through with you. Ahab responds, and this was the response I was looking for, verse 11, Amplified. King answered, tell him, a man who puts on his armor to go to battle should not boast like the man who takes it off after the battle's won. In other words, like, you may get dressed for battle, but I'll undress you when I beat you. Now, that's the verse I was referencing. Then God gets in on the dialogue and says this. Next verse, verse 12. And it came to pass when Ben-Hadad heard this message, he was drinking, he and the kings in the pavilions. And he said unto his servants, set yourselves in array. And they set themselves in array against the city. And so now you can almost hear him say, oh, it's on now. Ben-Hadad said, I'm going to take your land. I'm going to take everything. Ahab says, no, you're not. You may put your armor on, but I'm going to take it off. You can almost hear the crowd go, ooh, it's on. It's fixing to be a showdown now. And so that's the abusive dialogue. That's the rhetoric. That's the back and forth talk, sending messages to one another, threatening. I think they call that in a football contest, trash talk. But now the amazing deliverance. A prophet gets a word from God. He doesn't have a name. As a matter of fact, Elijah's not mentioned in this particular passage. You remember God had already told him, said, I've got 7,000 that have not bowed their knee to Baal. So one of these unnamed prophets emerge on the scene, and they go to Ahab, and they do what prophets did in that day. They're seers for the king. They warn him about ensuing problems, or they tell him about God's plan. They anoint kings, and they were invaluable to Israel in those days. And so he goes to Ahab, And this is what happened, verse 13. And behold, there came a prophet unto Ahab, king of Israel, saying, thus saith the Lord, hast thou seen all this great multitude? Behold, watch this. I will deliver it into thine hand this day, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord. Now, I call this an amazing deliverance because as wicked as Ahab was, God in his grace promises to give him deliverance. He said, I'm going to deliver this into your hand this day. I'm going to bless you with a victory. Now, Ahab is shocked by this talk because he can't believe he'd seen what had happened at Mount Carmel. In verse 14, he says, Ahab said, by whom? How's God going to do this? For me? And he said, thus saith the Lord. Got to do it God's way now. Even by the young men of the princes of the provinces. Then he said, who shall order the battle? Do you see his amazement? Do you see how he's baffled? Do you see how he's befuddled? He says, wait, who's going to do this? God's going to do this. Who's he going to use? He's going to use not your chief military people. He's going to use those young princes there. He's going to use the young men, the inexperienced ones. Well, who's going to order the battle? He doesn't know anything that's going on here, and he can't believe what he's hearing. And the prophet said, you are. Thou. So he's surprised at this. In verse 14, then he said, who shall order the battle? And he said, thou. And then verse 20, I'm sorry. So the young men of the princes of the provinces came of the city and the army which followed them. And they slew everyone his man. And the Syrians fled and Israel pursued them. Ben-Hadad and the king of Syria escaped on a horse with the horsemen. And so, vastly outnumbered, 232 men lead a charge, and they slay all of these Syrians who had much better equipment and certainly a lot more personnel. It is an amazing deliverance. So now Ahab can go and get back and kick back and relax and not anticipate any more trouble. We took care of them, right? Not so fast. Verse 4, the prophet has another word from God. He said, you need to anticipate that there are going to be future difficulties. Just because you've won this battle doesn't mean you're not going to have another battle soon. And the next battle may even be bigger than the last battle. But we live in a world where there's going to be conflict, there's going to be problems, there's going to be trouble. You're going to move from this battle to this battle, from that battle to that battle. There's going to be more, and sometimes they're even bigger and more difficult than the previous. The prophet has this word for the king. The prophet came to the king of Israel and said unto him, go strengthen thyself and mark, evaluate, plan out, strategize, and see what thou doest. For at the return of the year, the king of Assyria will come up against thee. Now God had told the prophet, after the first of the year, the battle's even going to be bigger. You need to go tell the king. And so he tells him to anticipate future difficulty. Verse 26 and 27 tells us more about it. He said, it came to pass at the return of the year that Ben-Hadad numbered the Syrians and went to Aphek to fight against Israel. And the children of Israel were numbered and were all present and went against them. And the children of Israel pinched before them like two little flocks of kids. But the Syrians filled the country. It was so lopsided that it would be funny if it wasn't so serious. This is an even more difficult battle than before. What's going to happen now? Well, I'm getting close to the conclusion. Hang on. Verse 28. There came a man of God to speak unto the king of Israel and said, thus saith the Lord, because the Syrians have said, the Lord is the God of the hills, but he's not God of the valleys. Therefore will I deliver all this great multitude into thy hand, and ye shall know that I am the Lord. You know, the word on the street is God's, you know, he helps everybody in the good times, but he forsakes them in the bad times. Don't you see those Christians suffering? Don't you see them, those Christians, they get confused, they get hurt, they get home, their homes get broken, their lives get mangled. Sometimes their children die even unexpectedly. Their bodies get hit with cancer. They lose their jobs. You don't see them singing then. You don't see them lifting their hands up and praising God then. Oh, yeah. Yeah, when it's Easter and things are good and they're walking on resurrection ground, yeah, they sing loud. You know their God. He's the God of the hills. He's the God of the good times. He's the God of the mountain. He's the God that they brag about and talk about after they got their raise. He's the God that they worship when it's convenient. They pray to him when it's necessary. Sing to him when it's popular. But you put them in the valley, they can't fight. They get confused. They get baffled. They get perplexed. They get befuddled. They get mystified. They stagger like the blind. They can't find their way. Yeah, we need to get them in the valley because their God is only a God for the hills, for the mountain. They can't fight battles in the valley. That's the word on the street about our God and how we act in the bad times. You could just about understand why they get that impression. Amen? I mean, think about it. People can serve the Lord, get involved in things that they're supposed to be involved in, come to church or be involved in ministry or do this, share Christ, give their testimony, say their prayers, read the scriptures when they're at peace. But when we're knocked on our heels, why is it so exceptionally hard to do those things? Do you compartmentalize God? Is he just the God of your hilltop experiences? Or do you get to know him better in the valleys? You know, David, he said, it's in the valley that he restores my soul. He anoints me. He's the God of the good times, and he's still God in the bad times. Now, either I left some notes, or is that the end? Is that my last verse? I didn't think so. But this is. Accept God's direction. Let me show you what I mean. Look at, well, I didn't use this. I didn't put a verse up here because I anticipated it. It might be a little long. But let me tell you about this, what happens. This is mind-boggling. So they go, by the way, those 232 soldiers and the armies that back them up, they go and win that second battle. The king hops on his horse and escapes, and he's so terrified, a wall falls down, kills 27,000 of his colleagues, and he's terrified. He finds, says chamber, one translation says closet. He actually goes and cows down in a closet, and he's terrified for his life because Israel's God must be God, and he can't whip him. So one of his men come to him and said, but you know what? These Israelites are always talking about merciful God. When they're always talking about how God has mercy. Maybe if you will put some sackcloth on and humble yourself and go meet the king, maybe he'll be merciful to you, let you live. So after he considers this for a while, he says, okay, I think I'll do that. So he goes, does the sackcloth, and gets himself in lowly apparel and comes before him like his humble servant. But he sends a messenger before him, and he says, Ben-Hadad wants to humble before you. He wants to ask for mercy. He wants to let you know that you're not going to get any more fight from him. I want you to watch this manipulative, devious, self-centered, biblically ignorant king. He said, you go tell him. He's my brother. And it's a term of affection. This is a man that wanted his family, wanted everything he had, and would have gotten it if God had not, intervened. But Ahab saw a chance to increase his kingdom, where sanctions would be lifted and a treaty would be agreed upon, and the things that Ben-Hadad's father had taken from Israel and Ben-Hadad had taken from Israel, that they would be given back. So he saw a lot of diplomatic things. He saw the economy being better. He saw his own territory expanding. And so he's going to make this deal because it's going to serve his interest best. And so what happens is Ahab goes to meet him, and he's in his chariot. Now, typically when a king would win a battle, he would take the king of the other territory to his chariot, and he would tie him to his chariot wheel, and he would have to put his shoulder on that wheel as if he were pushing that wheel and serving him like a mule. But Ahab says, no, you get up here. You're riding with me. And he strikes this deal with Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, which was already one of the most vicious of all Israel's enemies and would flourish again because Ahab wasn't willing to do what Elijah had already said do, where he said, Elisha's going to slay this bunch and Jehu's going to slay this bunch. And this, in other words, we're going to get rid of all this paganism. We're going to get it out of this country. And this country is going to be a country who is known that Jehovah is the Lord. And so he wouldn't take care of the enemy. I'm talking about Ahab. So he strikes his treaty with him and they agree to get along. And he lets all this stuff stay in Israel. All this pagan worship. Now he's brother, he's friend with the most notorious enemy that they had at that time. And so God's word comes to a preacher and says, go tell Ahab that I'm fed up. I won those battles for him. He didn't win those battles. You go tell him that he just signed his death warrant. I'm done with him. Tell him he's going to die. Now, how would you like to be the preacher that delivered that message to Ahab? Elijah had been before him, but this preacher we don't even know his name. So he says, I need a really good illustration. He probably remembered what Nathan did to King David and how he illustrated so it would resonate. And I don't have time to get into that. But so he says, okay. So he's going down the road and he's on his way to meet. He knows where the king's going to pass by. And he says, hey, brother, come here. This is a fellow preacher. Hit me in the face. I don't want to hit you in the face. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I don't have as much devotion as this preacher had. He's willing to do anything to get his message out. But I don't want you to hit me in the face. If you can't understand my message, I'll just try harder. But don't hit me. But the preacher says, hit me in the face. I ain't hitting you in the face. If you don't hit me in the face, this is God's will. If you don't hit me in the face, a lion's going to come out of the woods and kill you. It's ridiculous. I'm not hitting you in the face. He goes on his way. And here comes a lion. Kills him. We've got to do it God's way. He's not tolerating disobedience. So he says, here comes another preacher. He says, look, brother, I need you to do something. What do you want me to do? Hit me in the face. He must have heard the lion roar because he reared back and he punched his lights out. I mean, he drew blood. It's no problem. Or maybe this was a Baptist prophet that told a Methodist to hit him in the face, or a Pentecostal. I can't help it if you have no sense of humor. It's not my fault. But he says, hit me. He says, all right, here it comes. Wham. He says, ah, that's good. Thank you, brother. When men were men. So he puts bandages over his face. And this is all to set up the introduction to the sermon God told him to deliver to Ahab. And so he's sitting there by the roadside because he knows after he drops off Ben-Hadad at wherever it is he's taking it, he's got to come back down that road. He's sitting there and he's all, you know, he's feigning the whole, you know, I got beaten up kind of deal. King pulls over and says, what's wrong with you? And he's got his eye covered, most of his face covered. He says, oh, King, said it was a terrible thing. Said one of your soldiers had captured an enemy. And I was holding him like a prisoner of war and said, he told me, he said, whatever you do, he said, you know what the law says? If you let this man escape, it's going to be your life for his. So whatever you do, don't let him go. But I've got to go on and keep fighting this battle. And so here I was, King. I was looking after him real good, but I got busy doing this and I got busy doing that. And next thing you know, I looked up and he was gone. And that's what happened to my face. And I got, he just overtook me and overpowered me, just beat me up bad. King Ahab looks at him and said, what are you? You gotta be kidding me. You know what the law says. You know what's written. Said, you are gonna die. It is your life for his life. Prophet reaches up and pulls that patch off his eyes and takes those bandages off and says, no, King. Oh, and at that time Ahab looks at, oh my God, that's one of the prophets. King, this is on you. You chose to let your greed and your impulsivity and your passion, your lust for power and lust for wealth, you chose that over God's clear direction. And you have tolerated the enemy, our most notorious enemy. You have tolerated that enemy to live amongst us and proliferate his paganism throughout our culture. And you know what Elijah said about it. You know how they were exposed at Mount Carmel. This king is over. Now here for the summation. You're going to die swift and soon. Ahab did what Ahab often did when he got bad news. The Bible said he went home and sulked. He wasn't penitent. He didn't have remorse and say like David, against thee and thee only have I sinned. He didn't do that. He just went home so upset because, man, he just now had things right where he wanted them. And now God was going to take it all away. Well, that was his problem. He had them where he wanted them. Not where God wanted them. Now, Keith, I don't know that I'm going to do an invitation today, but let me say this to you. This is what I promised you. When battles baffle you, I mean, now we're really getting to the kind of the, I understand more what's happening at the end of this than I ever did reading those other 40-something verses. God knew that the land had to be purged. And so, though a lot of the rhetoric and a lot of the clamor and a lot of the staged, the threats, I meant to say, and the battles that really didn't accomplish a whole lot, it was all leading up to the point to expose that God would not have any other gods before him. And he's going to trouble our lives until we get that right. A second thing, those baffling battles teach us that we have a covenant-keeping God. Even the worst of us, if we belong to God, still get blessings, don't we? Ahab, I'm going to hand the king into your hands. I'm going to allow you the victory so that everyone will know that I am the Lord. That he blesses us in spite of us. He's a covenant-keeping God. Don't doubt him. A third thing, when your battles are baffling you, know this, God's never baffled. Every step you take, the Bible said, is ordered by the Lord. The steps of God's people are ordered by the Lord. He watches every move. He's there at every turn. And though you may be baffled, he's not. Last of all, the battles are not really yours. They're not really mine. They're the Lord's. And that's why they baffle us. That's why we don't always understand them. You see, the devil doesn't really hate you like you think he does. I mean, let's face it. I mean, you're not really that important. He hates the God you serve. And he certainly can't put his hand on God, so he has to put his hand on what God treasures most on this earth, and that's you. God's wise enough to understand that. He understands that that's not really your fight. That's all because of him. So he's not going to forsake you when you're baffled by the battles. God knows that what Satan's really after is God's reputation. If he can prove God a liar by letting you suffer without help, if he can prove that God is not faithful, he wins the battle. That's not going to happen. So when you're baffled by the battles, when you don't understand it and you feel mystified, befuddled, disoriented, you don't know why, and you're trying to figure out why this happened, why don't you just say, you know, Lord, help me to trust you that in your time, you'll deliver me. That's why that verse says, submit yourself to God and resist the devil and he'll flee from you. Get behind God. Get where God is. And the devil will have to flee. He's no match for God. We're mincemeat for him. I hear these people talking about, I'll just tell the devil this and I'll tell the devil that. I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to tell you what I'm thinking. You wouldn't last 10 seconds in the round with Satan. But greater is he that's in you than he that's in the world. He's not baffled. He's not befuddled. He's not mystified. He knows what's really happening. And he's undefeated, undisputed, heavyweight champion of all time. Would you bow with me as we pray? Father, such as it is, Lord, I did what I could do with it, but I pray you'd help somebody today. Lord, for that person that just so overcome with frustration, just so filled with anxiety or confusion or just misunderstandings about life. I think that cloud follows a lot of us around sometimes. But help us to understand, Lord, that that may be from the enemy, but the enemy of our souls and our lives is a loser. And he knows it. And you're a covenant-keeping God. You're not going to forsake us in those moments. You're not just the God of the mountains. You're God in the valley. You're God in the good times and you're God in the bad times. You don't cease to be God. You have no variableness. You have no shadow of turning. You have no place where you go and hide. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. His ears are open to the righteous. He hears our prayers. So when we're baffled by life's unexplainable battles, help us to send a prayer up to you and thank you that you know everything that's going on and you're in charge, and give us some direction and give us the grace to obey you.